You're listening to Cannabis Voices. People's stories in their own words about the healing power of the cannabis plant. So today I've got a real treat in store for this episode of Cannabis Voices. For anyone who's got a special interest in the endocannabinoid system, I'm talking to Dr. Greg Gerdman, who's a neuroscientist and has been involved with research into the endocannabinoid system practically since the very beginning, making some really exciting discoveries that are still talked about today. So it's a long one. I decided not to edit it down too much because there's too much juicy stuff in it. So maybe make a cup of tea, have a little break halfway through, but make sure you listen to the very end. There's some great little ECS tidbits that maybe you've never heard before. So enjoy.
Thanks for having me on and talking today. Yeah, I have a doctorate in pharmacology. So I was a doctor of philosophy, I guess, in pharmacology, a PhD. Prior to that, I have a degree in biochemistry and molecular biology. I've always been interested since my early, education days in the mind and the brain. And so I've long really considered myself a neuroscientist. My PhD is in pharmacology, but it is neuropharmacology, neurophysiology. And I got my degree from Vanderbilt University, mostly working there in the late 90s. I got my PhD in 2001. And the lab that I worked in was asking questions of really the neurophysiology of learning and memory and how cells in the brain adapt their connections over time, relevant to learning, also relevant to injury and protecting from injury and so forth. And I was there in a place and time when I posed a question about endocannabinoids. I learned what anandamide was. It had only just recently been described. This was in 96 when I was really sort of like laying out my PhD work. And to make what could be a long story short, I started looking into whether these endocannabinoids could behave at synapses in the brain in a way that we hadn't seen before, and led to some interesting discoveries that turned out to be true and impactful. And then I come to the study of cannabis and plant cannabinoids and their relevance to health and well-being from studying the physiology of the brain and as a neuroscientist looking at endocannabinoids. And I think it's fair to say I was part of a sort of a first break in the 90s, a wave break, so to speak, of like these endocannabinoids have been discovered as THC-like molecules. But great biochemists had done that work, right? But then it remained to ask, like, what physiologically are they actually doing? What are the endocannabinoids doing in the brain? And I had the good fortune and timing and right questions to be one of several researchers in labs across the world who helped to come up with some of those early answers.
So just to kind of unpack in simple terms, what is the endocannabinoid system and how important was its discovery?
I think we'll be appreciating for a long time how important the discovery was. Certainly more important than originally, I think, envisioned. And what I mean by that is this all comes out of the field of studying how cannabis impacts, the brain and body, how it impacts behavior, how it leads. There's been a very pernicious negative stigma about anything related to cannabis in the 20th century, in the second half anyway, right? So research in the 70s and 80s and 90s, biomedically, if you wanted to study something about how THC works, it was focused on addiction or, negative outcomes of consuming cannabis. And a relatively small number of labs were working to find out, what is the target for cannabis? How does it impact the brain and body? And that led to the discovery of receptors that came to be called the cannabinoid receptors. So a system, the ways in which THC and other cannabinoids act in the body essentially is the endocannabinoid system. It didn't carry that name at first, but scientists first discovered receptors by which THC and other cannabinoids can act upon the cells of the body. And then shortly thereafter, in the mid-90s, our own internal signaling system, THC-like molecules, came to be called the endocannabinoids, which is a shortening of endogenous or internal cannabinoids. So that's kind of where I started entering the world as a young neurophysiologist, is I was asking questions about how brain cells communicate. I happened to attend a seminar from a professor, Dr. Daniele Piumelli, and Daniele has been a pioneer in endocannabinoids. He was describing, it was a seminar where he was describing this molecule called anandamide, which had been discovered as activating the THC receptor, which we call the CB1 cannabinoid receptor. And light bulbs went off in my head, like, this is exactly the kind of thing I'm looking for. I got a little more specific in my answer to your question. I mean, basically, so the pursuit to understand how cannabis works led to the discovery of the receptors that THC and other cannabinoids interact with, especially THC. And then that led to a first aha moment, because these receptors are all over the brain. I mean, our brains are exquisitely wired to be responsive to cannabinoids. And so they must play a large role in regulating, nervous system activity. Well, then there's a second CB2 cannabinoid receptor, which is found in the immune system, and they're both found throughout the body. The point is, the system by which cannabis interacts with the body is a major, major regulatory, internal cellular
How was
mechanism.
that discovered, the regulatory nature of it?
Well, I mean, in phases, in that, I think in my view, the real primary observations are re related to neuroprotection and the control of seizures. Of course, historically, the clinical use of cannabis extracts to control seizures is a very rich one. It's been understood for a long time. The Irish physician O'Shaughnessy was working with seizures and control of tetanus-induced muscle spasms with cannabis extracts in India in the 1800s. It goes back further than that. But with animal research, so let's see how to say this. The cannabinoid receptors were discovered, and then the idea is that, well, there must be an internal system that uses this, not just that we've evolved to consume cannabis. And that's correct. And first of all, the question was, how do you measure these things? They were hard to find. The lab of Raphael Mechoulam primarily was responsible for discovering these things. Other workers were finding it in Japan and in the Czech Republic. But if you want to understand how these internal THC molecules work, you have to be able to measure them. And one of the things that was observed early on is when an animal receives an injury, including just taking the brain out to study it, the endocannabinoids were going up very quickly. So some careful research was done. I would probably name wrong who did it particularly, but one of in the Israeli group, they did time courses of, like, getting a brain out of an animal really quickly and doing head injury to animals, and finding that when an animal's brain, when a rodent's brain is injured with hypoxia, like with a stroke, an experimentally induced stroke, or with a traumatic brain injury, like a focal head wound, the endocannabinoids raise very quickly. And it had been previously known and was reiterated in what turned into snowballing amounts of research that THC and other plant cannabinoids protect against the damage from, say, ischemic stroke or head injury. So The first, in my view, the first that thing certainly, and I was neuroscience centered, so maybe this makes sense that this is the first thing I kind of honed in on. But the endocannabinoid seemed quickly became called sort of an on-demand defense against excitotoxicity and acute injury and oxidative stress that comes with a lack of oxygen, with ischemia.
And it was the on-demand because it was the retrograde signaling. Is that kind of part of how we know it's got this regulatory kind of modus operandi? Because it's only kind of kicks in when it's needed, right?
It call you're right. It's called an on-demand. It's by contrast to what are more conventional neurotransmitters. So if you're looking at communication of the brain, you're thinking about neurotransmitters, and they tend to be packaged up in these little vesicles that have been described by anatomists for over 100 years. That our transmitters are packaged up and they're ready to be released. And then when there's neural signaling going on, these prepackaged vesicles release neurotransmitter. But with the endocannabinoids, the molecules aren't there until there's in a, or at least they go up very rapidly. They're synthesized on demand. They're not stored and ready to be released. When a cell receives a barrage of activation of some sort, the endocannabinoids are literally synthesized right there on demand and released. And you bring up the notion of the retrograde signal, which is really part of is where I came in and helped to make some of the first. I was one of the people who came up with that idea independently, that I was looking for something that cells could be releasing and signaling backwards to their own inputs, and that's what was being discovered in the endocannabinoid field. It's easier said than done when you're looking at teeny to prove that that's happening was requires very sophisticated methods, but we found that neural cells, when they're receiving excitation, and for example, with a seizure where you've got electrical activity just impinging on cells, they synthesize and release endocannabinoids as a way to go backwards into those inputs and tone them down. And it is all much more nuanced than that. I view this retrograde signaling mechanism as a way that cells fine-tune their own inputs in order to what matches their, homeostasis, their natural role within their tissue or their circuit. Again, it's most easily, and I think this is the reason why it was sort of the gateway into getting to that, is because it's fairly easy to think, okay, if a cell's getting a super barrage of input and it's about to get overwhelmed, it's turning on endocannabinoids as a negative feedback to, turn, say, whoa down, damper this tone down a little bit, this input. But it, and in many ways, so for example, we started to understand that, and this is involves a great deal of different kinds of research, but the physiological stress response throughout the brain and endocrine system seems to be modulated by the endocannabinoids. When you have a high amount of stress and you get that fight or flight response, endocannabinoids going up in certain key brain areas like the thalamus and the hypothalamus are part of what turns that stress response off. And it just goes into deeper and deeper things. I mean, animals learn to get past traumatic fear using endocannabinoid signaling. The very perception of threat is in some way sort of gated by endocannabinoids, like a safety switch on a firearm, right? It's animals with a higher anandamide level in their fear centers of their brain and the areas of the amygdala are less reactive to threat. And if you put a human being in a sensitive, MRI brain scanner and give them a low dose of THC, those brain areas will be less hyperreactive to fearful, threatening stimuli. So the neuroendocrine physiological, circuit of stress is regulated at every point by this endocannabinoid system.
So it's kind of important then.
It's extremely important, you know, and over the course of these past 20 years or so, you see in very perfectly mainstream scientific articles in the literature describing the endocannabinoid system as a master regulator of human physiology. And I give when I've given talks about this over the years, I have to stop and say, like, this isn't like fringe. I'm not taking this from the cannabis culture magazines or something. Like, this is like as mainstream as science gets, calling the endocannabinoid system, which we only discovered because it's how pot works, right? The endocannabinoid system is a master regulator in human physiology. I've been reading and teaching the scientific literature for my whole adult life, and you don't see that phrase bandied about. And I tend to refer to the endocannabinoid system. Sometimes I don't even like calling it a system, because when we think of something like the dopamine system in the brain, there's like discrete cells that make it and where they project, and that's very nice and tidy. Or we talk about the musculoskeletal system as a physiological system. But the endocannabinoids are more like an intrinsic cellular mechanism that are all over the body. We got kind of duped early in the very first years thinking it's a neural and immune thing because the receptors are so high in the nervous system and in the immune cells. But endocannabinoids are released by cell types within every tissue. It seems like every physiological system and tissue, you know, important tissue interact, you know, system that we study, it can be modulated by endocannabinoids. So it's all extreme. It's extremely important.
I'd be interested to know about how the endocannabinoid system, well, the theory of how it developed. So was it to kind of help us survive? Because it's very much kind of involved with reward, right? So reward for going out and hunting and finding some food, reward for running and catching the prey, whatever it was.
Well, I mean, as an evolutionary biologist perspective, it certainly evolved to help survival and reproduction, and in one way or another. But I think that it is just incredibly robust as to how it has helped to support the evolution of, honestly, multicellular life. I mean, I've been going on very evolutionary questions where this system came from for quite a while, and part of my research focus when I was at Eckerd College was looking at the endocannabinoid system in marine invertebrates like sea squirts and lancelets and these animals that sit sort of at the base of the vertebrate tree of life, so to speak. And as you know, I've been involved with research that has proposed that the exercise-induced endocannabinoids is relation to the motivation to run and the so-called runner's high. Let me back up and say, I think there's a way you can look at it, like, how did it evolve? Where did it come from in terms of very deep time evolution of living systems? Because the endocannabinoid system goes back that far. And that's part of, I think, the answer as to why it's distributed so much as a cellular mechanism across all our tissues, is because it's absolutely primordial as far as being involved with how cellular communities communicate with one another. But then there's a question of how did it influence human evolution in particular, and we think that I mean, I'm part of a school of thinking and research that the adaptations of humans to be exercisers, to be runners, is a large component of that. Let me focus on that. Maybe we won't do so much into the into you know how various other organisms have endocannabinoids. But I think there's just this fascinating and rich area to understand how why did we evolve to be runners and to be exercising animals in the way that we are, and is that key for the endocannabinoids? So work that I did with David Reichlin, who's an anthropologist at the University of Arizona, went in that direction because he had studied the physical anthropology of running behaviors. And part of that understanding is that, like, unlike other primates, we have this upright posture and we've got these skeletal adaptations, muscular adaptations that are evolved to be distance foragers and runners. And you have this interesting sort of connections, whereas, as research has gone along, we know that when you exercise for 30 minutes, you get your heart rate up, 50% your max or so, you're getting some decent exercise. At least one of the endocannabinoids, an anandamide, goes up in your circulation. And in our studies, we found that that was very tightly correlated to an improvement in emotional mood. So we play it on the runner's high. It's not like I'm getting high per se, as much as, like, I like to think of it more as a runner's joy. It's a better mood state. Your emotion is lifted.
Is it
And
sustained? Because we talk about this, the anandamide, I guess, circulating levels increase. And I guess there's also, I think you talked about in the paper as well, that helps to kind of push through the pain barrier, maybe if you're running over a long distance, and it's, you have the anti-inflammatory effect, you get in the zone, etc. But then that kind of mood boosting effects, is that then sustained once your the endocannabinoids are broken down and everything kind of goes back to how it was before?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, does it lead to, like, a long-standing increase in sort of baseline mood? I think there are, much as I get focused on endocannabinoids, there's a lot more to physiology than, endocannabinoids and other aspects of improved fitness and the outcome of being more successful. Can they all interrelate? But, just the general idea of that piece of research is that, there's incentive. Exercising starts to feel good. Whether that's sustained or not may not be the point, because maybe if it dips back down, that becomes your motivation, part of the
Ah,
motivation
interesting.
to revisit the activity, right? It's a rewarding thing to do. So it's not like you get on a treadmill. I mean, actually, anybody who's done an athletic training knows that you do have to push through at a certain extent to start really getting rewards. But the idea is that our hominid ancestors were much more tree adapted, like other primates that are arboreal. And during the time period of the Pleistocene era, where widespread forests were starting to shrink into what became more of the savanna habitat in Eastern Africa, the niches of hominid survival were spread further and farther between. There is an adaptive need for foraging greater distances, and to the extent that there was hunting, that was probably an endurance-based hunting, where you can run animals to exhaustion, which still happens in some pockets of humanity, that there were certain incentives to run. I mean, certainly part of it is just survival, but why would we start to train in the first place? And maybe the feel good that is sought after was part of that. But it's various things, right? Because, like you say, if you're elevating your endocannabinoids, your pain threshold will go up. It helps to mitigate the aches and pains that are inherent in running. It helps to actually protect against some of the oxidative damage. And that we're also a huge body of research really is focused on how endocannabinoids are central to metabolism of nutrients in the first place. Sugar metabolism is regulated by endocannabinoids, and so it may have helped to support metabolic health. I mean, to make a very complex, subject simple, it may help to support metabolic health and how you get the how you use the nutrients when you get them. But with anandamide going up, is it just that you feel good? Well, there's also good evidence that anandamide helps to it enhances the palatability of food. So I think about it in terms of a like hunter forager when there's running. It's not just that running for 30 minutes makes you feel good, but you run, you get whether you get to the foraging space and you start, harvesting those yummy berries that you knew you had to run to, or you successfully capture prey, and you get food. And there's perfectly good reason scientifically to think that and that anandamide level that helps to mitigate the aches and pains and support the running behavior and motivate the running behavior. It also makes the food reward when you get there just that much more pleasurable and that much more rewarding.
And I guess, am I right in thinking that in breast milk, so when a baby is first starts to suckle from its mother's breast after being born, there are endocannabinoids in the breast milk. Is that right?
Absolutely.
So
This is something
that's going to encourage the baby, right? So if they're getting a kind of, a nice sensation as well as filling their tummy.
I mean, there's all these wonderful, supportive inputs. That was work by Esther Frieda and Israel, showing that in and if you block those cannabinoid receptors in animals, there's a failure to thrive. It really inhibits the suckling behavior if they don't have that endocannabinoid mother to offspring communication, so to speak. So, and there's lots of other interesting things that have come up. Like there were studies recently of sleep deprivation showing that the endocannabinoid 2-AG is increased in the sleep-deprived state. Labs that focus on this question of endocannabinoids and metabolism have started to go very far in terms of segregating the two endocannabinoids and what they do. So the two primary endocannabinoids that we know are anandamide and 2-AG. They both activate CB1 receptors. They've both been correlated to, hedonic state and feel good sort of reward system. Again, we're always biased towards that because it comes from the drug abuse sort of field and the feel good drive. But there's differences within them. Anandamide seems to be more of what we call the endocannabinoid tone. There's background levels of it, and if your anandamide levels are higher, there's greater resilience to stress. For example, it's sort of I view anandamide levels as sort of a stress buffer because of this tone idea. Whereas 2-AG is more quickly on demand, and for different signaling. And what's the relevance of that? It probably varies from brain area to brain area, but in the area of metabolism and reward, the body of research is kind of suggesting that, or is evidencing that. Anandamide helps to drive what we call homeostatic feeding, which is really like filling your nutrient need. And I think about a primordial, Homo sapiens running, and anandamide goes up, and it's fulfilling that eating that is like good for you. It's replacing what you've used. It's building, towards an adaptive state in your muscles. 2-AG may be more of a sort of binge eating, a snack eating. It may drive and more high caloric foods. And the exercise studies have almost all ours and several other labs show that anandamide levels go up after exercise. 2-AG really doesn't. I mean, there have been observations. And it all gets very tricky because these endocannabinoids cycle with circadian rhythms too. And part of what's interesting there is the circadian rhythm of 2-AG is pronounced, and when human subjects are sleep deprived and are only given like 4 hours of sleep a night, as opposed to the controls that have like 8.5, the 2-AG levels go up substantially in this morning, daytime, or early afternoon rise, and it's correlated to more craving of sort of like high energy snack food, sort of behaviors. And that's long been known that sleep deprivation drives, even when it's not really creating that much more of a metabolic need, it drives snacking behavior. And the 2-AG endocannabinoid aspect of that may be related to it. So endocannabinoids help drive feeding behavior, but part of why we have two of them may be related to this. Like, and it's probably too simplistic, but I've started to think of maybe anandamide as the more surges of anandamide help to promote more adaptive homeostatic eating, and surges of spikes of 2-AG may be more the snacking sort of eating.
And outside of talking about kind of appetite and feeding, etc., is there this kind of difference in their activity, say, I don't know, in psychological conditions? Because yeah, sort of I remember doing some research to in looking at sort of the endocannabinoid system as a biomarker for depression, for example. And depending on whether it was kind of PTSD, I can't remember if there was more 2-AG than normal or less, but in anxiety there was less anandamide. So it's very kind of complicated. I think we like to have a nice little story, a nice narrative, and maybe there isn't one. I don't know.
Well, it is certainly very complicated, and yeah, there's evidence that endocannabinoid levels, and I forget where anandamide versus 2-AG has been sparsed out. Even people who think about this a lot, me being in survival mode and doing various different things these past several months, I lose track of how complex this is. But there's evidence that, if, for example, that women with depressive disorders may have a lower endocannabinoid levels in their plasma. There's evidence that people suffering from PTSD have lower CB1 receptor density in areas of their brain. There's other studies showing lower endocannabinoid levels in the plasma. There's studies showing that acute public speaking stress raises endocannabinoid levels, presumably as a way to counter that
Because
stress.
this again is something that I find interesting, because you sort of talk about, or one reads that the dysregulated endocannabinoid system could be a contributing factor to different pathologies or to many pathologies. But then on the other hand, with this kind of homeostatic regulating effect, presumably often it's just the endocannabinoid system doing its job, right? If there's more signaling, for example. And how do you know which is which?
Well, it's incredibly hard to tease these things out, and research, there's so much to research, because again, we're calling the endocannabinoid system this master regulator, right? And it clearly, by it's a very short extension to say it could be dysregulated in conditions that are, unhealthy, syndromes or illnesses and what have you. And it, certain places this has gone to be increasingly sophisticated. In some areas related to what we call like central sensitization seem to be related to perhaps a clinical endocannabinoid deficiency, as Dr. Ethan Russo has coined it. And these are things that sometimes are seemingly diverse, like GI issues, like irritable bowel syndrome, Crohn's disease. They share some interesting commonalities with migraine and fibromyalgia, which is something that some clinical practitioners don't even recognize, fibromyalgia, but these various states of central sensitivity, being too sensitive to pain, being too sensitive to visceral challenges, may be a deficit in endocannabinoids. And we get this concept of an endocannabinoid tone, right? But does that mean that you've got a high or low levels of endocannabinoids? Does it mean your receptors are up or down regulated? It could mean any of those things and still call it endocannabinoid tone. What are endocannabinoids doing in the plasma in the first place? They elevate, but then they decline. They get broken down quite effectively in the body. What cells are releasing those endocannabinoids? I mean, are we only measuring them in the plasma as a side effect, you know, because they could be, that's the thing, endocannabinoids are such a basic fundamental mechanism. If you're exercising, is it coming from skeletal muscle that we see in anandamide? Is it coming from the blood vessel lining themselves? We don't really know that, and we're just at the cusp. But again, when I was first getting started in this 20 years ago, well, okay, it's a little more than 20 now. The only funding to study this was National Institute on Drug Abuse. There was no funding into cannabinoid receptors unless you're looking at marijuana as being something dangerous. And that's all very much changed. I mean, there's research prerogatives across all the National Institutes of Health in the US and globally. Scientifically speaking, the cat is long out of the bag that this is a system of health and well-being, and that the cannabinoid molecules, whether you're making them from a plant or you're a drug company trying to synthesize something proprietary, that this is a real avenue for trying to treat a whole wide range of wellness. And for me, it came to a point that many, many people have, that it just, you know, in my mindset, when I see all these collusions of industry and profit motive and how long it takes novel drugs to become therapeutically impressive, and it's, you know, you have this movement arising of people who are using herbal cannabis because it's as natural as you get, and you can do it as a commonwealth right to something that human beings have had since before recorded history. It's an incredibly safe thing to try. So human beings should have the liberty to try cannabis as medicine. And, you know, I'm a scientist. I can be as skeptical and scrutinizing as anyone, but when people are making claims that cannabis helps them, whether it is for regulating agitation and autism or seizures or just my day-to-day social anxiety disorder or Crohn's disease, it sometimes, you know, the wide variety of things that cannabis, you know, as evidenced to help, can be its great undoing, because we've been so programmed that it's just a drug of abuse is
And
a bad thing.
until you bring into play the endocannabinoid system, right? Because then
Exactly.
as soon as there's more education about there, it's like an aha moment, isn't there? It's like, okay,
It
now I understand why it
is.
can help so many seemingly unrelated, because it just seems too good to be true, right? I mean, how can,
Damn.
you know.
And it has to me at times over the years too, you know, especially issues related to cannabis and cancer, right? I was certainly in the scientific, you know, arena of saying, like, let's not go too far, people, right? Cannabis actually directly fighting cancer. I was very skeptical about that. But, you know, it like you say, the endocannabinoid system has changed everything. It's important, the narrative and the story we tell ourselves, understanding how and why medicines work. You know, I'm lucky. It's something that still makes it, I'm still getting mileage off of lab research I did 20 years ago, because people are still interested. It was ahead of the time then, and now you've got cannabis industries of such a booming, you know, world. For good and bad, all kinds of interests, you know, that any kind of successful industry can create. And every company, science washes their content on the endocannabinoid system, right? And there's so many sort of repeated stories about, you know, cannabis works because it boosts your endocannabinoid system. Here's the basics, like what we've been talking about, retrograde signaling. Most people read that and they see it's a stamp of rationale, of validity. There is a real biology here. And that's been part of my message over the years. We don't know all of how it works. Sometimes I just get downright tickled at the idea that we ever will. But we do know that it's resoundingly safe compared to other things we take as medicine. And the rationale for why cannabis could be therapeutically valuable from everything related from diabetes to, you know, OCD, there's a biological rationale there. And I think that is part of what, you know, should is changed the tide of things in a good way.
And presumably then as well, if we're, because I know you did a great interview for Project CBD when you were talking about the endocannabinoid system being the kind of gateway to wellness, right? So, there's a lot of, people talk about cannabis medicine, but it is if you're supporting the endocannabinoid system through the cannabis plant, it's also a way of facilitating wellness by taking it. In the UK and most places in Europe, we can't legally buy cannabis actually, as easy as the United States, and so we have access to, on the whole, to CBD oil, and it is sold as a nutritional supplement. And while, yes, of course, it's medicine as well, but I think it's almost right actually, that it's both, because it is part of wellness as well. If you're helping to maintain this extraordinary system that is geared up to keep us in balance, and then at the same time, almost everything we do in modern living, eating junk food, not sleeping enough, being sedentary, being incredibly stressed, everything's kind of set up to actually, all those things negatively impact the endocannabinoid system, right? I think there is kind of research to back that up. So we need to kind of supplement it in some way, just to help us be well as human beings.
I would agree with that. And it makes perfect sense that augmenting a system that is generally it just a huge body of research supports the endocannabinoid system in general working in this multifaceted way to support homeostasis and wellness. The notion that augmenting that through your diet or physical activity or what have you would be therapeutic, it just makes very good, perfect sense that that would. And the cannabis plant is nature's, queen of supporting the endocannabinoid system or boosting it. There are other herbs and biological sources of molecules that probably work by boosting the endocannabinoid system. And including that, our concept of what is the endocannabinoid system is absolutely expanded. There are other receptors, in particularly these TRP family ion channels that are also activated by a variety of plant molecules, hot peppers, garlic, menthol. I mean, these receptors that are involved in our senses in many different ways are also activated and modified by endocannabinoids and plant cannabinoids. So, the problem is we can err into this just black box, it sort of loose statement that, well, cannabis supports the endocannabinoid system, therefore it's good for you. And, a judicious use of cannabis, in my view, doesn't the being very being something that's healthy and something cannabis that has a good source of cannabidiol being something that's healthy in my view doesn't necessarily validate that someone doing 500 milligrams of THC in a concentrate doing dabs and hitting these oils at high concentrations is going to be healthy for them. And in fact, there's evidence that the endocannabinoid system in terms of the CB1 receptors compensate and downregulate from that kind of high THC activity. And there is evidence that high levels of THC, chronic ingestion of high levels of THC throughout adolescence could lead to untoward neurocognitive effects. A lot of that research tends to get, I think, overblown, but it's nonetheless not something I would argue that it can happen. So it's not a blank check to say that cannabis activates the endocannabinoid system. Therefore, whatever my habits are with cannabis, they're good. And I'm also, at the same time, I'm not trying to say that high dose THC isn't important medicine for people in their particular situation, because I've seen plenty of instances over the years, plenty where people improve their quality of life taking high dose THC. And some of the people who have claimed success fighting tumors have done so with very high doses, and that makes sense. Take it to another direction. In the hemp cannabis world, genetics, are starting to be solidified where we're about to see much more CBG kind of bigger role. CBG has always been around. It's the parent cannabinoid that THC and CBD are born from. But genetics are getting much more popularly available to farmers, where at least in the U.S., we'll have a lot of this year, the hemp industry, farmers will be growing a lot of plants with high CBG. So accordingly, we're going to see a lot more CBG in commerce. And so what's that going to look like when we're putting on our website as to why these things are good? I mean, are all these CBD vendors that are just a glut, you know, going to go out and take their flags down and just change the D to a G and say, CBG, it's healthy too. Why? Well, because it modifies the endocannabinoid system. Mm-hmm. But, and I'm not hating on CBG by saying this, but we can't just have this. It seems weird to just wave your hands and say the endocannabinoid system is magic. So, you know, stimulating it is better.
That's my question. That's the thing. I mean, it becomes a marketing tool in a way. And I do wonder. I mean, I've just go from saying it, you know, it's a nutritional supplement. But if you're well, basically, if your endocannabinoid system is kind of working okay, do you need to, you know, kind of throw a bunch of cannabinoids at it to make it work better? I question that really.
Does it work better? I mean, I don't know. I think taking a cannabis supplement, having it in your life on a regular basis, is probably going to be a health benefit, if only by dampening inflammation. I think inflammation in the body is, you know, a key towards so many chronic illnesses, and loads of research, preclinical animal research, have shown that moderate doses of cannabinoids lower inflammation, and I include THC in that. I include CBD in that, even though they have compellingly different effects in the body.
Okay, can you kind of just unpack that a little bit, because they're very different mechanisms, right? In terms of how they interact with the endocannabinoid system.
And CBD interacts with all kinds of neurotransmitter receptors. The physiological impact of that, hard to say. In many instances, for different reasons, you know, partly because because the way the endocannabinoid system is popularized as a marketing tool, if you get it gets popularized by people that don't really have the training to discern a good paper from a bad paper. And, you know, some of the findings that CBD may interact with, you know, one receptor or another are stronger than others. And sometimes science is published that doesn't pan out to be real. Kind of going on a tangent here, but what we do know is that THC and CBD both have multiple, you know, modes of action, targets of action. But THC acting at CB1 receptors to activate them and CB2 receptors to activate them is certainly a primary role in its psychoactive and various therapeutic outcomes. CBD does not directly activate those receptors. In fact, it can act as a negative allosteric modulator, which is a fancy way of saying it hits a different type of the side, different edge of the receptor, but makes it less responsive to THC. This is now pointed to as the, you know, mechanism that would explain why significant levels of CBD present can help to lessen the intensity of THC psychoactivity. Not that you can't get high with CBD present on board, but the incidence of like really overdoing it and having that sort of what gets called like a toxic psychosis, but the reality of, oh my God, I thought I should eat the whole cookie and I should have stopped hours ago. And that, you know, I sometimes shy away from saying a THC overdose, right? Because it's not going to kill you. And that's part of this, the amazing aspect of it. You can vastly overdose on THC. It's not going to kill you, but it can make you feel like you're going to die. And just intense psychoactive, you know, negative anxiety, paranoia, having CBD present seems to dampen that. That happens much less when CBD is in balanced amounts.
Does it only dampen the psychoactivity? Because if you're kind of changing slightly the binding effect of THC on the receptor, does it also dampen the other therapeutic, I don't know, the anti-tumoral, the apoptosis, all that kind of stuff?
Well, interestingly, in tumor cells, CBD and THC both promote apoptosis and the programmed cell death, that is, of cancer cells, but through different sort of convergent pathways. Just part of what, you know, could make it that all the more compelling if you're hitting a tumor from multiple aspects. And this is one of the fantastically compelling still mysteries about cannabinoids. They're so central as a cellular mechanism. We've known for over 15 years now that THC and CB1, either one, or THC and CBD, either one have antioxidant and neuroprotective properties. And it's another term for this is pleiotropic. It's hitting a singular outcome or a similar outcome through different mechanisms. And overall, it's protective, right? It protects against free radical damage. It protects against excitotoxicity and excess calcium. Except when you put it in the context of a tumor cell, a tissue that's growing in an unregulated way and becomes cancer, suddenly these resoundingly neuroprotective or protective molecules, I cut off the neuro because it's not just the neurons, the resoundingly protective effects of cannabinoids suddenly become the enemy of the tumor cell and trigger programmed cell death. Why is that? This is actually something about what motivated my direction to look at chordate invertebrates when I was at a teaching college where most of the kids were marine science focused. We're right on the Gulf Coast of Florida. I traded in my animal research with mice and going to animal care facilities and looking at rodent brains to going out to these beautiful beaches and, you know, shoveling for invertebrates that were hiding down in the sand. And, the reason why I did that is because, follow me here, I know I'm going on a little aside, but I think, you know, we talk about the evolution of endocannabinoids. I think we have a tremendous deal to learn by looking at the metamorphosis that goes on in our early vertebrate origins. When you look at the earliest animals that are like at the base of the vertebrate tree of life that all vertebrates came from, they are organisms that go through profound metamorphosis. I'm referring to sea squirts, that when they're adults, they don't look like animals at all. They're just a tube that siphons seawater and releases, you know, sort of eats and shits and throws out gametes now and then to spawn. But it's a total sessile, sedentary organism, the sea squirt. And a British colleague of mine, Maurice Elphick, very fantastic pioneer in endocannabinoids, was one of the first to show that sea squirts have cannabinoid-like receptors and endocannabinoids. What are they doing in this animal that doesn't do much? My research as a professor at Eckerd College never got the publication. I was always working with undergraduates, and you're learning more than you're, you know, getting real research done. But we started looking at the first stages of life of the sea squirts when it's a tadpole, and it actually looks like a vertebrate animal. It swims, finds a good place to live its life, and it goes through this radical metamorphosis where it's never going to move again. That process of metamorphosis that vertebrate animals evolved out of, it involves tissue reorganization and tissues that, you know, a tissue that was useful at one stage in life no longer is, and so it gets programmed to die. And other tissues get programmed or are innately programmed to thrive and develop. And we started seeing that the cannabinoid receptor gene was like this mosaic in this swimming tadpole. It would be on in one place and then on in another place. And on here, right close to this, high in this gut tissue that needs to be preserved. And I don't want to say too much about our specific findings because there are a lot of controls that I wasn't sure was real, but I think that the endocannabinoids are a cellular mechanism by which tissues determine whether their neighborhood is doing okay, their cellular neighbors. And if there's a certain barrage of input, whether it's genetically programmed or based on your environmental conditions, endocannabinoids are released to sort of keep the cellular environment happy. In early metamor in these organisms I studied where there's a metamorphosis that has to go on, there's this complicated tissue repatterning that goes on, and the endocannabinoids seem to be involved in that. And in my mind, that is relevant to what goes on in cancers. I mean, it's a long stretch. There's huge question marks in between this, right? But cancers are a phenomenon that encompass a wide range of disease. You know, every tumor is different. Even within a cancer, you've got three or four different types of cells because the error checking of DNA replication just goes awry. And so errors start going in. As cells divide, they're making more and more errors in their DNA, so it becomes more and more carcinogenic, as you will. And I think that some of the early safety checks that a cell is going wrong involve the endocannabinoid system. And some of that helps to promote natural killer cells and other forms of immunity that recognize cancer cells and eat them up. And we all experience cells in our body that become potential cancers, and our body's immune system recognizes it and destroys it. I don't know. I kind of went spinning off on a side story there. I don't know if you're following me,
I
but I
am
think that
following. I am
studying the
following.
deep evolution, I think studying the deep evolution of vertebrates and how endocannabinoids became so central has huge keys to unlocking what are the triggers for what makes it protective versus what makes it toxic,
Right.
which happens during cancer
Yeah.
cells. I think it happens during the metamorphosis events of these early vertebrate ancestors. So studying those animals might provide direction to some of the real keys in cancer biology controlled by cannabinoids.
Something that I found interesting that you spoke about before, which I hadn't really heard about before, was that there is a background level of anandamide, I think you were talking about. So
Yes.
I'd never heard of that before. So that means it could be possible to actually measure at some point in the future, have a kind of, a blood test to measure your anandamide levels.
Yes, although importantly, that anandamide tone, so I was talking about anandamide tone, for example, in the amygdala, making you more resilient to stress. But that's a very small brain area where those anandamides maybe generate are probably being generated quite locally. So let's say I have a high anandamide level in my amygdala that makes me resilient to stress, less likely to get PTSD. I'm not sure that that's going to correlate to levels in my blood compared to you and me. Maybe it does. There is a big interest in this kind of thing. How do we get like a genetic or blood test for endocannabinoid tone? The first steps, which are already commercialized, focus on looking at metabolism. You look at the liver enzymes that break down THC and CBD and say, oh, well, you've got this haplotype. You probably break your low metabolizer of THC, so you better watch out. You can get overly high too easily. Similar work is done in other, whether you're looking at nicotine or drugs that are used for, therapeutics. But there's new and interesting research. I mean, case in point, one that pops in my head is very relevant to what we're talking about. I've long thought that conditions like anorexia, are related to the endocannabinoid system. It fits all of these areas that I've been interested in, whether it includes appetite. Obviously, anorexia is a eating disorder and leads to sort of self starvation. But there's evidence that's have come out fairly recently in a lab out of Cagliari, Italy, that in animal models of anorexia nervosa, that there's downregulation of CB1 or a lower level of CB1 receptor, and even that it gets epigenetically regulated, so that like the DNA promoter region of the CB1 receptor is altered, methylated in certain ways that change the receptor's presence. Now, in terms of people living their everyday lives and not studying science and just wondering how the things help them. Maybe this means someone with anorexia has a lower CB1 receptor activation. They have less drive to eat. They may have, and we know that anorexia has got various complex psychological aspects to it, related to motivation. And we still end up with cannabis as a medicine, sort of in this area of, well, try it and see if it works. And if this variety with this cannabinoid and terpene profile doesn't quite work, maybe this one will. And, we have to be honest to say there's a whole lot of placebo effect in there, but it's also tweaking your biology of wellness in a way that can support your own healing.
So that's changing your through excuse me, through phytocannabinoids and potentially things like exercise and other activities that seem to increase certainly anandamide levels. Can you then change your endocannabinoid tone?
Maybe a study that just came out recently, in the exercise physiology realm, it was a metabolomic study of exercise in Australia. And by metabolome, we mean looking at all your spectrum of metabolites, that go in your body, everything from free protein to things like lipid intermediates. What's going on in your body? And so this is an interesting study that I looked at, and then it looked at soldiers recruited to the military, and studied their before and after an 80-day intensive physical training regimen, right? And it's interesting, being a military, all male military, I think it was all male, environment, where they were in the same environment. They had the same food. I mean, precisely the same diet, the same training. And so there's a certain removal of variability that is got some benefits to it. And, because I've studied and been part of a lot of literature showing that, 30 minutes bout of exercise elevates anandamide, not so much 2-AG, if at all. And that we, like we said, that we relate this to why we exercise in the first place, how it promotes well-being, and moreover, the idea that, it might help inform us when to, as therapists in the world recommend and even prescribe exercise for things like depressive disorders. It helps to have a story as to why it is good for you. But anyway, this military study was the first I've seen that looks at the real chronic effect of exercise in a controlled way. And they looked at many things, but among of what their findings is that the endocannabinoid 2-AG went down. So then we're looking at baseline, and it does matter what time of day they were measuring plasma levels. So I need to go back and scrutinize that well. But it's interesting that maybe with exercise training, and promoting wellness in that way, that there is a homeostatic decline in 2-AG, which, recall, I said maybe the endocannabinoid that drives more high caloric sort of snacking behavior. It's interesting that sleep deprivation sort of bumps 2-AG up, and chronic fitness training may drop it down. Maybe all of this is related to, I'm sure it's related to all of this integrated, wellness aspect of endocannabinoids. The big question is, I think, that we're dancing around is this idea of personalized medicine. Are we going to be able to look at your profile, either genetic or blood test, and say, hey, this variety of cannabis would work for you, or this pharmaceutical would work for you? And in general, I think there's a whole lot of optimism, and who knows how well it'll really work, because we are exquisitely complex systems. Homeostasis is the basis of physiology, and something goes out of line one way, we come back to our set point. But certainly, people have health conditions that distinguish them from healthy populations, and to the extent that we might have a blood test or DNA test to say, well, you have a real endocannabinoid deficiency, this is the stamp of approval that to try cannabinoids, I think we'll get there. Or saying, hey, you've got a risk factor for schizophrenia that's very clear. You might tell your 15-year-old that we now have really good genetic data that maybe you are the person that you don't need to be waking up and smoking heavy weed every day, because it really could help put a little fuel on that fire. It's not that cannabis is like some switch that's going to make you schizophrenic. I think that, but as we understand risk factors, these kinds of predictive tests will be more useful.
And in parts of the world where cannabis isn't so readily accessible, I mean, you can get cannabis everywhere in the world, but not everyone's comfortable with, finding a dealer and the rest of it. What else can we do to, because I intuitively I feel that right now we do need to kind of support our endocannabinoid systems because, we're doing less exercise, we're stressed, there's a lot of uncertainty. For me, I feel like all these things aren't doing our endocannabinoid system any favors, really. So what else can we do that's not phytocannabinoids to try and support our dear ECS?
Yeah. Well, I mean, so we've hit the phytocannabinoids and exercise. It's really important to get up and moving. And people do need, it's fun, it's weird that we need so much motivation to get moving when it is healthy for you, but we do, even those of us who work out a lot. I mean, I was reading an interview from Michael Phelps the other day, the swimmer, being candid about fighting major depression, which shows that it doesn't matter how successful you are, you can still sometimes feel like you're the worst. He talks about having to drag himself up in the morning to go to the gym, and you'd think like you have like a dozen gold medals, you would just pop up and go to the gym. But anyway, it is hard. And so the fitness piece, getting up and moving, finding exercise routines, even if you're in an apartment, is an important way of feeding the endocannabinoid system and promoting balance in that way. Also, there are getting your diet right. I mean, having the sort of healthy balance of polyunsaturated fatty acids, those that omega-6, omega-3 fatty acid. And I'm not a great nutritionist. I always forget like what's the ratio you're supposed to have, but those polyunsaturated fatty acids that have long been associated with improved cardiovascular health, which is like the number one problem. You don't want to, you start going down chronic poor cardiovascular health, and that leads to worse problems with everything. Those polyunsaturated fatty acids become the precursors for endocannabinoids. And I don't want to swipe too simple a brush to say, hey, if you eat plenty of, fresh, wild caught salmon, your endocannabinoid levels go up. But a lot of the healthy, having a more healthier balance with the oils that you ingest, whether they're flax oils or fantastically enough, hemp seed oil is a great source of these. That kind of so-called Mediterranean diet, as it says, gets a good reputation for a reason. That helps to promote, I think, a good pool of the lipid molecules that support a healthy endocannabinoid system. And by contrast, the various high saturated, sort of artificial fat, high fat diet that has become, in the literature, it's called the Western diet. Well, what can we say? The modern agriculture turned petrochemical industry has pushed all of these, food-like chemicals on us. And having that high fat, high saturated or fat diet is, I believe it's fair to say, has likely its negative effects on your health are related to hurting the endocannabinoid system. Inflammation, stress and inflammation are highly interrelated. And the reason I talk about cannabis always likely being having something healthy for all of us is because chronic inflammation, whether it's arterial disease or Alzheimer's disease or Parkinsonism, chronic inflammation is a key aspect to unhealthy aging. And The plant cannabinoids are not the only source of fighting inflammation, but they're certainly a very, very good one. And other ways to fight inflammation could just be other, herbs and various colorful foods have these polyphenolic compounds that are antioxidant, and that's healthy for you.
Something that I found interesting was this study that came out. I think it was off the back of a TV program actually here in the UK that was comparing. It was the subjects were women in their 60s who were members of a choir, and they basically performed different activities. One of which was singing with in the choir with their choir leader, and then I think they were on a, an exercise bike in a gym. And the other was dancing, I think. And I think you're aware of the study that actually the most anandamide boosting activity was singing with their friends in the choir, which kind of got me thinking. And I think actually the researchers, kind of highlighted this as possibly a weakness of the study, was that it highlighted potentially how doing something that you love and being kind of joyous. Anandamide joy is actually boosting your endocannabinoid system, and so it's this idea of preference, I guess, that's involved as well. I mean, I guess, would you think that that's something that's possibly a kind of valid idea, that finding your joy can also, and doing it can give you a little boost?
I do. I think it can become kind of circular, right? Does your anandamide promote your joy or vice versa? They're both true. And I think I actually love that study. It's open access. People can find that. My old friend is Saoirse O'Sullivan is on that paper, who's one, someone I've sort of joined this field at the same time with. And I do like that a lot. Now with exercise, there's also been some studies, letting people exercise at their own rate or just a prescribed rate, like we did. We told them exercise like this, we made them run. And we even did it with dogs too. And dogs, their anandamide levels go up.
Unless they're not allowed to run, right? I found that fascinating. Dogs that weren't allowed to run, their anandamide dipped. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, it actually did. They were just sort of walking but couldn't run. Whereas ferrets, who are not running animals, when they were forced to run, their anandamide level didn't go up. That was part of our evolutionary thinking. But with humans, if you prescribe a running intensity, and they anandamide levels go up, but sometimes even preferred lower levels, it goes up as well. I probably don't summarize that study eloquently, but I do like the idea that our joy, amplifies. There's a sense of like being happy because you're happy, like putting a smile on your face, forcing it actually does, increase your mood. But then I actually have a quite a background. I used to be in choral singing. My parents met in a church choir. I used to sing a lot, and there certainly is a physical activity involved in that breath control and working. And it's not as passive as reading a book. And I think if it's something that you enjoy and you've trained and you're focusing on it, you are engaging your physiology quite a lot. I'm into West African hand drumming. I've been a djembe player for many years now, and honestly, there are a few things that get me as high as in it. There's just a certain way of being naturally high when I get into a zone and I really, just feel something musically. Of course, there's high activity when you're hitting a drum as well. Would that elevate endocannabinoid levels? I have no doubt that it would. In fact, I think there's been a group drumming study that has shown endocannabinoid levels go up. There's research now on resistance training, weight training, you point out choral singing. There are lots of different intrinsic, happy behaviors for people that elevate anandamide levels. And I don't think they had a control group of people who were not choral singers, but probably having someone, with trying to read music or singing karaoke. I mean, maybe it wouldn't have gone up as much. I think part of this, you know, as a neuroscientist, when I start to think about what's the next level of complexity, part of the reason it's hard for us to understand is we still think of our brains and our as sort of like packets of neurotransmitters, you know, and like, hey, your serotonin levels went up, so you are going to be less depressed. And since off the top of my head, I use that example, it also shows how incorrect it is. You know, the example of serotonin and antidepressants, traditional or antidepressants block the reuptake of serotonin. Serotonin acutely goes up, and the idea is that leads to some better outcome with depression. But we actually know that therapeutic success with antidepressants doesn't come for weeks, and there's reset going on where the serotonin levels are probably actually lower. But it sets a trigger of a cascade of events that involves nerve growth factor and the genesis of new neurons, where if those medicines have success with you, there's a, and then it's probably due to increased neurogenesis. Well, the endocannabinoids and plant cannabinoids promote neurogenesis. That's a piece we're not even going to, but it's part of what I love to think about. I mean, back to the, I'm taking a little tangent here, but you know, back to the running behaviors. I mean, there's this, we know that running elevates endocannabinoids. We also know that endocannabinoids stimulate neurogenesis. We know that human beings, as hominids evolved, our brains got increasingly more and more complex. What drove that neurogenesis? Maybe the running behavior out of necessity drove it, because running maybe make you more successful as hunters, but the cognitive demands grow up. You've got to learn spatial environments, a changing landscape, much more than just staying in your home couple of trees. You're running, you're thinking about where predators have been seen and where they might pop up, and generalizing, and just the spatial navigation required to be a runner. It creates more from a evolutionary perspective, it creates more of a natural selection pressure. There's a positive pressure to evolve if those ancestors who started growing more brain cells in an adaptive way, in a way that gets integrated well, the increasing cognitive complexity and brain size helped enhance survival. Well, there's a lot of conjecture with what I'm saying here in that exercise elevates endocannabinoids, endocannabinoids elevates neurogenesis. The growth of brain areas and cognitive complexity drove human evolution, and it was related to running behavior. And you know, that these things all squish together in some fascinating story of who we are is just like part of what makes living fun to me. And the endocannabinoids are critically there. Now, if you want to read some interesting pieces about that, my actually co colleague, my buddy Dave Reichlin, and some of his collaborators have written about this in Scientific American. If you Google like why we evolved to run or ex evolution of exercise, there's some lovely articles about their long relationship research studies with hunter-gatherer groups and their evolutionary questions. You know, part of what they've studied is that with chronic running behavior, the energy, the excess energy that we spend running in more sedentary people probably just goes to power inflammation. You know,
Right,
so
okay.
I don't even remember what your first question was that I just went off on that was. You know, I think I had some interesting directions to go, but.
It's been really, really interesting. And I think we should all be incredibly grateful to our endocannabinoid system because it's driven our evolution, hasn't it? And I think we need to kind of remember where we've come from a little bit in our evolution as a species, because as the further away we get from those origins, and, you know, the more we sit on our fat bottoms, watching TV, eating junk food, drinking loads of alcohol, all that kind of stuff, the unhealthier we become, and the less likely that our endocannabinoid system can do the job that it's evolved to do.
And unhealthy correlates with unhappy, you know, and I hear people say you got to die something, but why not be happy? I do believe that the narrative of what we tell each other, tell ourselves about who we are, why we're here, what causes disease and illness and wellness, it empowers us and it fills our life with meaning. And the story matters. And I don't want to make up just any story. I believe in science as far as dissecting and learning what's real and what's not. And so the endocannabinoid story is part of who we are. It's a huge part of who we are and where we came from. And it is part of a major part of our evolution. And then, to remember that we also are fascinated by this plant we love, cannabis. I mean, has cannabis driven our evolution? Maybe. It certainly has driven the evolution of society. The relationship between humans and cannabis is definitely one of biological mutualism, meaning we've helped the cannabis plant evolve, no question. I mean, like genetically, species-wise, evolve through selection. We know that human beings have had a relationship with cannabis since before human history. We also know that among those very first pieces of history of human writing in any language, cannabis appears on it. So this plant has spread around the entire globe because human beings have deliberately cherished it. It's not just that it's had some value, it's been cherished for lots of reasons, and it's still just a central part of human social discussion. I mean, it's and all of this, interrelates to this system of health and well-being, and I don't proselytize that everybody needs to smoke weed every day to be happy, but everybody should have the right to, in my view. Maybe that's a good power of the
Okay. Well, that's been brilliant, Greg. Thank you so much for
Thank you.
sharing your knowledge and your experiences. Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Cannabis Voices. If you have a story to tell about cannabis and your health, get in touch on Twitter at Mary_Biles. Together we can shine a light on cannabis and her healing gifts to humanity.